You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
In July last year, the Court of Appeal ruled that the blanket ban on assisted suicide in this country was lawful. Under the Suicide Act 1961, it's a criminal offence to encourage or assist anyone to end their own life. In the latest challenge to this ban, the appellant, Noel Conway, had been given less than 6 months to live, and he wanted the option of taking action to end his life peacefully and with dignity, with the assistance of a medical professional at a time of his choosing. After he lost the case, the Supreme Court refused to hear his appeal. I'm here with Sarah Wootton, Chief Executive for Dignity in Dying. The campaign group supported Mr. Conway in his journey through the courts. Sarah, many thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Rosalind. Pleased to be here.
You describe the decision in Conway as a grave injustice for dying people across the country who want to have a say in how and when they die. Can you expand on that?
I think that the decision's a grave injustice for dying people across the country who want to have a say in how and when they die. The critical point is that the Supreme Court said in 2014 in Nicholinson that the current law on assisted dying could be in breach of dying people's human rights. And of course, MPs failed to address these issues in 2015 with the Maris Bill. So effectively, the Supreme Court opened the door with its judgment in the Nicholinson case, but has now decided not to follow through. And it's a real bitter blow for Noel and others who, like him, who want control over the manner and timing of their death. I mean, it was clear from the judgment that the Supreme Court judges felt there were insufficient prospects of success for Noel. And I think that's probably because of the individual facts of Noel's particular disease, and in particular because he could withdraw his non-invasive ventilation, his oxygen mask, and request sedation and expect to die within hours and days. But what Noel says about that is that he is very worried about that option, that it would be very difficult for him to be sedated, for somebody else to remove his oxygen mask, for him to not know whether the feelings of drowning that he experiences when that's currently removed would happen to him when he was unconscious, how his family would react to seeing him slowly suffocate to death, and also whether he would wake up potentially during that process. He says that he wants a quick and humane end to his life, and he feels that withdrawing the treatment would not give him that option.
The factual scenario there is very difficult for people to understand, because what is essentially the difference between giving sedation and taking somebody's ventilator off? It's going to lead to death. What is it that is legal about that that wouldn't be legal about medically assisted dying?
I think that's an absolutely critical point. So the Mr. Y case that the Supreme Court judged on in July last year was very clear that for patients who have not got competence, that as long as their doctors and families agree, then life-sustaining treatment can be withdrawn from that patient, even though they lack competence, and that you no longer have to go to court to have that decision made. So how can it possibly be safer for treatment to be withdrawn from a non-competent person who, you know, isn't aware of what's going on but will still result in their death, but yet a competent person can't request treatment and take the final action themselves that will cause their death with upfront safeguards and so on? It's absolutely clear that this law has to change. And with 100 million people around the world now having access to assisted dying legislation, it's about time it did.
It's extraordinary that in this country, which is so progressive in many other respects, just we're not head-to-head with places like Oregon and other member states of the European Union. But just whilst we're talking about the relationship of our law to other countries, I understand that one of the main arms of your campaign is to persuade the legislature and the judiciary that being forced to travel in order to obtain a humane and medically assisted death is unreasonable. And what are the options for people who can travel, who have the resources and are able to?
Well, at the moment, it's Switzerland that people mainly go to, though Belgium is now starting to allow some Britons to travel there. And there are a couple of clinics in Switzerland that do accept Britons. But you have to be able to, one, travel before you're too unwell to make that journey. And secondly, you have to be able to pay probably around £10,000, including all the sort of costs of the journey. You have to go twice, you have to get various records and so on. So it's a significant amount of money. So you've effectively got a two-tier system now where people can afford to can have a reasonable death abroad, but people here who can't afford to are denied that option. So in effect, we're outsourcing a problem to Switzerland. Somebody's going, a dying Briton is going every 8 days to Switzerland to have an assisted death. And we recently published the true cost of Dignitas, which is a research report which just goes through some of those people, some of those families who've had to go through this process and what it's meant for them and their loved ones doing that. It's hugely unfair that the law doesn't allow that in this country, and it's very, very unsafe because the blanket prohibition means that the only safeguard around people accessing assisted dying abroad is a possible retrospective investigation of their family's motives after they've returned. So there really are no upfront safeguards around people accessing assisted dying. It's all about people having the money to access it now.
Talking about the laws that exists at the moment, in 2010, I think it was, the guidelines for the Director of Public Prosecutions were introduced. And essentially, you can't go ahead with a prosecution for assisted dying unless the DPP gives his consent. And the guidelines were put in to kind of soften the criminal law. But how do you feel they've actually worked in the 8 years they've been in place?
So Dignity in Dying took the Debbie Purdy case, which ultimately forced the Director of Public Prosecutions to publish his policy on the factors he took into account on who he was going to prosecute and who he wasn't going to prosecute, the reasons for that. And obviously Debbie won eventually at the Supreme Court. And at the point she won, over 100 Britons had an assisted death in Switzerland. And some of their relatives had faced very lengthy investigations by police. Some weren't prosecuted, but they still had the kind of the fear of prosecution hanging over them. None were actually eventually prosecuted, but there was a real concern about what was going to happen. There's a real lack of clarity in this area. So the friends and family of terminally ill people seeking an assisted death overseas faced a terrible dilemma: help their loved one have the death that they chose, or break the law, which said that they could go to prison for 14 years for doing so. So the prosecuting policy basically clarified absolutely that compassionately assisting somebody to die at their request is very unlikely to be prosecuted, whereas malicious or selfishly assisting or encouraging someone to die almost certainly will be. And I remember at the time, the Times said it was a victory for common sense and compassion, which Dignity in Dying absolutely endorsed completely, because the prosecuting policy has allowed many more people to make informed choices about the end of their lives and the consequences for loved ones if they assist people. And clearly it would be much more preferable to have the safeguards in advance of somebody having an assisted death, and the current situation where the prosecuting policy only gives advice after that has happened is not ideal, but it is a real step on from the situation that was there and the complete absence of clarity that British citizens faced in terms of accessing Dignitas and other clinics in Switzerland.
It's good to know that it has had that positive effect, and maybe this is obviously a step in the right direction. I just wanted to ask you about the distinction, it's a very important distinction, between assisted dying and assisted suicide.
So assisted dying is for a dying adult, and this is the law that Dignity in Dying campaigns for. It's for a dying adult, so somebody who has a condition that cannot be relieved by treatment and is likely to die within 6 months. And that is defined in British law currently, the 6 months criterion. And so that is assisted dying, as we term it. Assisted suicide is the choice of an adult who is either unbearably suffering, they may be disabled, they may have a mental health condition, but they are not going to die in the near future. It is about them having an assisted death, them choosing to end their life effectively and control the timing of their death and replace their life with a death. And euthanasia, of course, is around when somebody else takes the action to end someone's life, be it a doctor, and that's what's available in the Benelux countries where euthanasia is lawful at the moment.
I mean, a lot of people would argue, and of course it has been argued in the courts, that allowing a humane and autonomous choice of dying for people who are so disabled that they can't do it themselves anyway and they can't lift the lethal poison to their lips themselves means that it's very discriminatory and hard on disabled people who aren't also terminally ill.
Well, Dignity in Dying's policy reflects the views of the British public, and I think this is a critical point about assisted dying legislation, which is available to 100 million people worldwide, but the different policies in different countries reflect the stances of those citizens. So for Britons, 82% of the British public support the choice of a dying adult to be able to control the manner and timing of their death, but that support falls away drastically to about 50%. If you ask whether people who are disabled but not dying should have that choice. So this is really around reflecting public policy in terms of what Britons want. And if you look at the countries, the American states which allow assisted dying, Australia's just legalised in the state of Victoria, and other states are very likely to follow. There's a big debate in New Zealand, which is also probably likely to follow in the near future. I mean, Canada's law is slightly different as well. It's somewhere between the Benelux laws, the European laws, and the American laws. So it's really about crafting something that is right for this country. Ultimately, Parliament has to decide. It's getting the right balance between autonomy for the individual and protections for society. But what Dignity in Dying thinks is that this is the right policy, this is the policy that we're putting forward, and then parliamentarians will have to decide. I think we can all agree that the current blanket ban is not working and the law does need to change.
Those of us who've been watching this baton being passed between the courts and Parliament for years now are very frustrated, particularly as the Supreme Court has just decided not even to hear the appeal in Conway. What was the view of Dignity in Dying when you heard that result?
Well, we were very disappointed, and we did expect or anticipate that Noel would get to the Supreme Court, and we were very clear that was the only place where the declaration of incompatibility could be made. Still, it's very important to recognise that even though it didn't reach the case, Noel did secure a hugely important legal gain because he did establish that the courts do have the authority to decide assisted dying cases. The Ministry of Justice argued very, very strongly that it was Parliament that should decide these cases. And it was very clear from all the judgments that the courts do have the authority to make that declaration. So I think that that is really important. Equally, Noel's case has galvanised support and debate across the UK, you know, with significant media and public attention and very successful events in Parliament, in both the Westminster and the Holyrood Parliament. So it really does go back to Parliament now. And I think that, you know, MPs' stances are very important and they have shifted. That's the important thing to be clear. I mean, Noel's own MP, Kowczynski, has changed his mind on assisted dying, but he's not alone. There's a significant number of MPs who have changed their mind as a result of Noel's case and listening to the issues. It's not just parliamentarians that have changed as well. I mean, I think this is a progressive, incremental campaign like many others that have gone before it. Historic campaigns like women's right to vote, abortion, gay rights. There are huge similarities between these kinds of campaigns. And the medics have a very important role to play here. So the Royal College of Nursing is now neutral on assisted dying. The Royal College of Psychiatrists is neutral. But the Royal College of Physicians is due to survey its membership next month, and it may go neutral as a result of that survey. So it's really around getting other organisations and other people to have a look at this debate, bearing in mind the overseas developments here. The other important point is the other territories within the United Kingdom. So, of course, there was that very important debate in Guernsey in May last year, which ultimately lost the vote, but it again galvanised other parts of the UK to have the vote. So Jersey's now looking at having a debate, and the Isle of Man, which recently passed this very progressive abortion legislation, is also going to potentially have a debate later this year. Scotland's looking at this too. So it's really around re-looking the legislation in this area. So there is no silver bullet to this campaign. It's around incremental progress. And I would argue that Dignity in Dying has made progress in the courts as a result of Pretty and Purdy and Conway. And obviously Nick Linson has added huge change in context as well. And I think that it's likely to be other cases coming down the track to pick up the baton where Noel left off. I think Parliament has shifted considerably. We've actually secured, I mean, the House of Commons is moving, but the House of Lords, there is now a majority for a change in the law where there once wasn't. And then, as I've said, the doctors, the healthcare professionals is a critical area for Dignity in Dying.
Well, of course, they're the people most exposed to possible prosecutions for implementing any change in practice when the law hasn't changed.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I would argue that they're very unprotected at the moment, and they're in a very difficult position because obviously they are effectively abandoning patients who go to Switzerland. And I've heard many stories of people saying that they sought to protect their doctor. They didn't want them to know that they were going to Switzerland. So they couldn't ask for advice. They couldn't ask for their support at that critical point. And clearly it wouldn't be doctor's decision. It would be the patient's decision about whether to have an assisted death. And under the process that Dignity in Dying's arguing for, there would also be a family court judge involved in that process. So really what the doctors would be looking at is eligibility into the scheme that Dignity in Dying is proposing. But at the end of the day, this is about autonomy and the individual deciding themselves, the dying individual deciding how and when they die. It's that transition between life and death that is so troublesome occasionally that we're trying to sort out.
And that we as a society have been very reluctant to talk about until quite recently.
I think that's right. I think it was Isaac Asimov who said that, you know, life is pleasant, death is peaceful, it's the transition between the two that is troublesome. We are not willing to talk about that as much as we are, but we're not encouraged to by healthcare professionals. I was interested in the recent publication of the NHS 10-year plan, talks about the personalisation of care. There's not enough in it about end-of-life care. There's not enough in it about multi-morbidities either. But in terms of personalisation, I don't know that it necessarily engages with this shift of power that needs to come from the healthcare professional to the patient, which is very much needed at the end of life, so that with all the different apparent possibilities around treatment, the patient needs to decide, understand what the implications are for them for certain treatment, and make decisions with the healthcare professional about which route they want to go down for and what the implications are for them. That is proper shared decision making.
Sarah, Dignity in Dying obviously has been helping these individual litigants that we've discussed, but also there are stories that haven't gone to court.
Yes, I mean, I've met a number of incredibly powerful individuals whose stories have really struck with me. I mean, for example, Christy Arnston, who was a witness in the Noel Conway case. And Christy has incurable breast cancer, which has recently spread to her bones. She's only 50 with a youngish family, and she's been told that she has a 5% chance of surviving the next 5 years. And what she says, and I'd like to read it out if I can, is that, you know, I believe that in the last weeks of my life, when I'm dying anyway, I should be able to choose to die on my own terms. Why can't I have a dignified assisted death to prevent me from having to live through the last few weeks of pain and anguish? A planned assisted death would be so comforting for me now. I want to concentrate on living and not have the fear of dying constantly nagging at the back of my mind. And I think that thought is so much a theme that runs through assisted dying where it is lawful overseas. So 40% of people who get the prescription in the US don't actually go on to use it. It's just knowing that they've got the option gives them the comfort. And not knowing that you've got the comfort of that option causes real distress and people to take very difficult actions, like Kevin Davis, who had terminal renal cancer. He felt that he would have really liked the choice of assisted dying, but instead he tried to hang himself at home and died alone in a pool of blood at the bottom of the stairs because he didn't have that option, which I think is absolutely outrageous. Susan Strong is another person that I've spoken to whose daughter, Fiona, was only 31 and she had cancer and suffered very much at the end of her life. She did choose sedation. She would have gone to Dignitas if she'd been well enough to make the journey, but she wasn't. But she woke up 20 minutes after she'd been sedated. And over the next 4 days, she continued to wake. Her mother actually said goodbye to her 7 times. And it was awful. You know, she wanted to kind of be pain-free and keep her dignity intact. And hearing Susan talk about that experience is incredibly powerful and moving and really makes me see why the law needs to change in this country.
LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.